Welcome to Net Zero Investor with Mona, where we discuss how investors tackle climate change, the biggest issue of the 21st century. Today, we want to talk about a new consultation covering reporting standards and transition planning launched by the UK government last month. And that potentially puts quite a lot of obligations on financial institutions like pension funds and asset managers. I'm really pleased that we've got Faith Ward and Michael Marshall joining us today. Now you'll have to bear with us, dear listeners, because we've got quite a few job titles to navigate here. But Faith is Chief Responsible Investment Officer at Brunel. She's also Chair of the Institutional Investors Group on Climate Change. And she is one of the working group chairs for Scaling Finance and a member of the UK Transition Finance Council. Michael is Director of Investment Risk and Sustainable Ownership at Railpen and also co-chair of the UK and European Working Group IIAG, which is part of the IISB Investor Advisory Group. Thanks for joining us today, Faith and Michael.
Thank you very much for having us.
Thank you.
Now that we've made it through all your job titles, which is actually quite interesting, I think you're really both best placed in commenting on this. We've seen this consultation, it hasn't gained a huge deal of coverage and it's launched over the summer, which is quite tricky. And some of our listeners might be thinking, well, why do we even need it? Because we're already doing TCFD reporting. Can you tell us in the most basic terms, what is the difference between transition planning and TCFD reporting?
Thank you, Mona. And you're right, the timing perhaps is a bit suboptimal, but the importance most certainly is not. So one of my motivations for joining you today is because I do think this is incredibly important that investors, corporates, other stakeholders really engage with. There's a whole series of consultations underway this summer, and hopefully we'll dig deeper and bring some light onto that for all your listeners. But to address your question around TCFD, so obviously the Task Force for Climate-Related Financial Disclosure, the TCFD, is a disclosure framework. It's there to how a company or investor has identified kind of the risks and opportunities presented by climate change, whereas a transition plan is much more sort of action orientated. It sort of is the where do I want to get to, the actions or levers I'm going to use to do that, the time frame, and also how I'm measuring the progress against that. So there are lots of overlaps between the two. In many ways, TCFD is foundational for a transition plan. It has many of the similar elements in terms of sort of good governance, how you're building this into your strategy, even with like scenarios where it asks you about how your company will be impacted under different warming scenarios. The idea with a kind of plan is more kind of where do you want to get to? Where does your company want to see itself in the future? As one of my peers described it, where do you want to be when you grow up, if you like? You know, where the more intentional, it's more action orientated. I also feel the difference between the two could also be summarized between kind of being a future taker into implementing safety and a future maker with respect to kind of transition planning, your ability to kind of steer your company or your investment in the direction that you want to go in relation to sort of the climate transition. They say they are very interconnected, but they are trying to answer two slightly different questions in terms of the climate transition.
I already alluded to it in my intro, but let's talk a bit about the potential scope of these reporting standards, because this could really directly impact some of our listeners, like pension funds, asset managers. Although it's not quite clear how to look at the consultation, what exactly the AUM size is. Obviously, for TCFD reporting, we've got quite specific AUM thresholds. Here it just says economically significant organizations. Do you have any idea what that could potentially mean?
So usually when we talk about sort of economically significant, this is usually defined in either the number of employees or, as you say, either assets under management or sort of turnover limits. I think this is an area that I think it's worth us sort of giving a little bit more thought to, and it's something I'll be kind of putting my thinking cap on during the summer for the consultation deadline in September, because I do think it's quite important to think a bit of this a bit more laterally in terms of where can transition plans really add value. I think size is definitely important in terms of that sort of economic significance, because that by definition that often relates to the number of people that are sort of employed and jobs and protecting those jobs and how you could be like a resilient company in that regard. But I think we also need to think about climate and carbon intensity. So what is economically significant, particularly from the UK's perspective, carbon budgets that it's trying to operate within. There could also be quite a good way of looking at it in terms of consumer-facing brands. If we are trying to make transition plans work for everybody in terms of being decision useful, and we're trying to change perhaps behaviours or enable and inform consumers to make informed decisions about choices, then having transition plans that underpin those disclosures in the direction of travel for different corporates, particularly those consumer-facing brands, could be really important. So whilst I don't have an inside track on kind of where the government is thinking in terms of where it might draw the lines, I do think this is worth some consideration as to what would actually sort of enhance and deliver the outcomes that we're trying to meet, and not think of it perhaps just seeing size as being the only parameter. That's very much from a sort of a company perspective. Obviously, again, I think probably mirroring elements within the TCFDs are probably a very sensible start from a sort of financial institutions perspective, because again, as I've alluded to, TCFD very much is quite foundational to sort of transition planning. So I think using that as a basis for sort of rolling things out, I think is quite important.
Michael, do you have any thoughts on like what would be a sensible threshold for this kind of reporting work?
Well, I think as Faith mentioned, there's several ways to look at this, and I would encourage all different stakeholders to participate in the consultation and give their unique perspectives. From our standpoint, we'd want to see the disclosures if the risk factors were financially material to the company in question, from our vantage point as an investor trying to provide great outcomes to people in retirement. For us, we have a financial materiality lens. As for who gets above that threshold or below it, I do think there's a conversation to be had about proportionality. Just like companies, investors are also having to manage multiple demands on their time in terms of producing good quality information out into the market for various stakeholders, including regulators. There are smart ways to do this using joined up thinking, and there are perhaps less smart ways to design all of this. So I think there is a question of proportionality which needs to be addressed. But from an investor standpoint, we want to be able to manage portfolios, all the risks in those portfolios, including climate related risks. And so when a business is material to our portfolio, we'd hope and expect to see disclosure on that point. One final remark would be that in your opening question, you said that your listenership might be thinking, oh, we've just done TCFD and now there's another consultation, and perhaps people have a little bit of fatigue with these things. But I would say that that's actually a reason to participate in the consultation, which is currently out, because the risk of fragmentation and the risk of additional complexity is something I think that everybody would want to avoid. So the opportunity to try and harness and make consistent the forthcoming requirements, I think, is an opportunity not to be missed.
That's an important point, and I feel like you're speaking slightly with your IASB hat on here, because part of the idea behind this consultation is simplifying the whole process, isn't it?
Yes, that's exactly right. And I think I'm biased because we're out there and public supporters of the ISSB. But I think that the ISSB and some of its precursor organizations are outstanding contributors to the harmonization of disclosure standards in this field. And without their intervention, I think we'd be in a worse place in terms of the fragmentation of different disclosure requirements across the globe. We are global investors. And so the importance of having a globally consistent baseline of comparable and decision useful information can't be overstated. And it's really pleasing to see the ISSB grasp the mantle here. There's a huge amount of work to promote the global adoption of a global baseline. And looking at the latest statistics, there are 36 global jurisdictions that are either deciding to use or taking steps towards introducing the ISSB standards in their legal and regulatory frameworks. And that actually accounts for a disproportionately large amount of GDP, so around 60% of global GDP and around 40% of global market capitalization. So it really does have momentum. And I think the benefits, both for corporates in terms of disclosing to a harmonized, sensible, proportionate framework that they themselves contribute to, and for investors in terms of having comparable and decision useful information, that's a really important endeavor and something that the working group is laser focused on.
I wanted to talk about the potential implementation pathways, and that's where I feel like there's a lot of unknowns in that consultation still, and potentially also opportunities to influence where it's going, because it outlines three potential implementation pathways. And that ranges from comply or explain, which is probably the most easygoing on investors, over to mandatory disclosures, which applies for like a lot of like UK investors on TCFD, for example, up to mandatory implementation, which would potentially be the most far-reaching step. What do you think is the most likely pathway to be adopted?
I think the government has asked that question, so it needs to listen to the correspondence that it gets. Again, another reason to promote what your views and your perspectives and to share those. I think trying to second guess where this might land, I think, with the regulatory sort of environment at the moment is futile. But from our perspectives at Brunel, we have advocated it's within our climate policy to for mandatory transition planning. However, there's a difference between sort of mandating process of transition planning and having that particularly focused on the most largest, most impactful companies. And then we, as Michael alluded to, about the sort of proportionality and materiality and using those to kind of roll over time. So you kept capture more of the sort of value chain supporting those companies, I think is important. But there is a difference between mandating implementation and mandating disclosure and all of the component parts of that. So we are very strong advocates of wanting to have that process in place and to have that mandation in terms of to undertake the activity and to make that disclosure. However, we do support the idea then of complying or explaining why certain bits work and do not work for you, perhaps in any guidance document or advising. So I don't think some of the options are necessarily mutually exclusive. So I think comply or explain is a very rational and very reasonable framework, because we know and have learned our lessons over different disclosure frameworks in the past that one size does not fit all, that even with the regulatory disclosure requirements on financial institutions for TCFD, for example, some of the metrics being recommended, they work very well for perhaps listed markets type portfolios. They don't work quite so well in private markets. They may not be the most useful metric to actually measure the risk component of that. So not mutually exclusive, but we are certainly strong supporters of mandation in terms of the process and the requirement for disclosure. I would start with the largest, most impactful companies. I would also encourage those who are smaller and those who are sort of, as I've indicated, maybe consumer facing, who could really max out the benefits of transition planning, that they start to do that on a voluntary basis with the view to them becoming part of the mandate process over time. That probably summarizes what will go in our response.
Michael, where do you stand on that spectrum?
Well, perhaps I could just pick up on Faith's points around the relevance of metrics, making something that is decision useful. We at Railpen have used what's called the SASB framework, the Sustainability Accounting Standards Board framework, for many years in our investment process. And the framework really helps us guide helps guide our analysts to find what is financially material when undertaking sustainability analysis of some particular company that we might invest in on behalf of our clients. And historically, the standards have had a little bit of a US bias. I should say that the standards, I think, are one of the biggest achievements of the sustainable investment industry, a really high quality, evidence-based piece of work that many investors have adopted. Nevertheless, in the first iterations, the metrics promoted by the standards tended to lean on US federal agencies. And so the metrics had a bit of a US flavor to them. And that meant that investors had to tweak and customize their use of the standards for their own ends, for their global portfolio. Hence the push for a globally consistent baseline using what's now romantically called S1 and S2 for climate for the disclosure standards under the IFRS. But I just wanted to maybe highlight for some of your listeners who may be less aware, the work being undertaken by the ISSB to make the underlying SASB standards globally applicable. Because as Faith rightly says, the relevance of the metrics actually produced, it's the be-all and end-all for the disclosure being useful. So over the course of years, SASB has, or the ISSB have been making the underlying SASB standards more globally applicable. There's a comprehensive review right now of extractives, resources sector, plus the processed foods industry. There's 41 industries that are having their metrics further aligned, and this includes some of the high impact sectors that Faith was referring to, not only in the climate space but in the sustainability space more generally, such as water management and how health and safety metrics are incorporated into the standards and therefore disclosed by companies and therefore utilized by investors. And it goes on and on. So the advantage of ISSB, I think, one of them, is that the standards that are promoted and are shaped by industry, by corporates and investors. And so there's a real live conversation about proportionality, decision usefulness, relevance, and so on. So the consultation may fall over summer in the UK context, but the importance of broad participation in the consultation is really high in the UK context, and the same is true for the ISSB adoption globally.
Just to come in on that, Mona, I've sort of made some sort of interventions and a call to action for corporates to provide insights as to what they find useful in terms of measuring the risks themselves and how they would operate, and also for sector specialists within financial institutions to really engage with these SASB standards and really provide those sort of industry insights, because we want this to work. This is such a unique opportunity to kind of get this all, as Michael says, to harmonise, to all work together. We know that later on in the summer, for example, the EU is going to also be opening a consultation on how this relates to the European standards in regards to corporate reporting and the requirements, and then in future sort of financial institutions. So this is a fantastic opportunity to kind of make it all, as I say, fit together and so that it'd be useful for both companies and investors alike, and really push back a little bit on perhaps this perception around sort of reporting burden and really streamline things so it's efficient.
And now really is the time to influence that decision. If you are concerned as a listener about the reporting burden, you can, I guess, state it in some way by providing feedback. At the moment, it's quite abstract what we're talking about, but what could be some of the practical challenges if we actually were talking about implementing some of these measures? Maybe you can give some specific examples.
I think that the areas or the, some of the barriers and challenges are similar to those that we're facing across the sort of industry more broadly. And data, I think, probably is one of the sort of classic components of that, and the availability of those metrics, which is why the sort of SASB industry specific guidance that will underpin these reporting standards, but also then support the thinking around what's needed sort of going forward with transition planning, I think are so critically important, because it's about material, what is most useful and decision useful sort of data points. I think we also, I mean, certainly from our own personal and practical experience, we manage more than we measure. So we don't have necessarily measurements for some of the areas in which managing risk. Context is incredibly important. So recognizing that sort of contextual information and that qualitative information to make sure that your story, particularly with transition planning, what it is you're planning to do is very clearly communicated. And I think that can be quite tricky. I think one of the most significant barriers in all of this, though, we're looking at it slightly at a sort of more macro scale, is policy. It's quite challenging for a company. It might want to define where it wants to go. But one of the areas that transition planning really pulls out is dependencies. What are you dependent on in order to deliver your plan and your objectives? And a lot of that comes down to the policy environment in which you're operating in. So this very much connects quite strongly to some of the other work that I'm involved in with supporting the UK government in terms of the credibility guidelines around transition finance. How do we actually mobilise at scale more sort of financial flows to allow for the transition and to enable companies to make those steps? But quite that in itself is also dependent on like sectoral decarbonisation pathways and transition planning at a more sovereign level. So that sort of real clear guidance as to where the direction of travel for internationally as to where countries are going, I think allows corporates and investors then to be able to assess and contextualise the information they're receiving. So these aren't particularly unique to transition planning, but they are particularly pertinent, I think, to some of the barriers and challenges. But hopefully the process itself, by highlighting those, will actually then lead to those being addressed over time.
Let's come to the point of enforcement. Michael alluded to that earlier, that there was like a slight US bias. I mean, in the UK context, who would actually be enforcing this?
So with the manifesto promise as set out by the Labour government at the moment, it was to focus on obviously FTSE 100 and financial institutions. So there you look to the FCA. So that's their role, is to be that sort of regulatory force in that context. I think that depending on what the scope is and how we roll that out, I think it needs to kind of pick up and have involvement for different sort of regulatory bodies, particularly those perhaps in sectors, and how they could play a role in providing that sort of input and guidance and support in different, as I say, different sectors have sort of regulators that sort of operate within them more broadly, particularly in some of the sort of hard to abate sectors and areas of industry. I think what's really important is some of the more recent sort of legal opinions that have been shared about, because I think there have been some concerns around sort of the legal risk. And I think sort of the work by Client Earth in terms of the KC's opinion about there being very low risk in relation to these statements of intent and the ambitions being set by company. And that's very much clarified that sort of legal risk position. And for instance, that's one KC's opinion. We are advocating, probably within our response, we'll also encourage the when it comes to more the follow-up consultation that will come from the FCA, talk about things like safe harbour provisions. You know, can we create or use that concept of being able to provide a safe space for companies to make sure that their ambitions can be high, but recognising that there will be dependencies, not all of which will be in the control of the company, but recognising that, but and really sort of empowering and enabling them to be able to progress on their ambitions without that risk or those concerns hanging over their board and their company.
I just wanted to advance that point on enforcement, if that's okay, just share a couple of thoughts from, yes, from our experience. I think we may have been too hopeful in our previous theory of change about getting better and more complete disclosures, in the sense that there was a hope that if pension funds and asset owners go first and asset managers go next and companies go after that, then through that value chain, you will force others to disclose ever better information. I'm not quite sure that has worked out as planned. It's been partially successful, I would say. So I'm really pleased to see the perhaps slight change in tack, and that the Financial Conduct Authority, as it should, would be a really important enforcer. However, it's important that there isn't simply an enforcement of the fact that something was disclosed, a simple tick in the box, but the quality with which those disclosures are made and how they're utilised by investors.
I think you need to have an enforcement mechanism. That's undoubted. We need to have, you know, quite having a regulatory approach and mandating without it. However, I really don't think that's the right lens with which to approach transition planning. If you see the surveys, there is multiple different statistics, but all of them are very strong support in terms of both how corporates perceive the usefulness of transition planning, how investors perceive the usefulness of transition planning in terms of their sort of fulfilling their objectives. So government has sort of said that this is central to how they're going to deliver growth. It's how they're going to deliver jobs. It's how they're going to make our economy more resilient. So I think it's more looking at positives of why would you not do this when it could unlock growth and potential sort of opportunities. As sort of Michael alluded to, I think one of the surveys said that 84% of investors said they were more inclined to finance companies if they have a transition plan. Well, that's a pretty, you know, strong supporting sort of message to those. And that very much underpins some, let's say, some of the other work that is very complementary to the transition planning, which is I'm doing with the, you mentioned my role, Transition Finance Council. So those seeking financial, either in the creation of products within financial services or companies looking for sort of transition finance support, having a transition plan and looking at what levels of expectation would be good to then identify and unlock those first. So hope that one of their ambitions is that their cost of capital will decrease, and also the access to capital would increase as well. So decrease cost of capital, increase access to capital, both of which are positives for corporates through the provision of transition planning. So I'm more looking at this in a sort of a lens, through that sort of more positive lens, rather than the sort of more sort of enforcement lens in terms of why we should promote and see this as a positive development.
Thank you, Faith. I think that's a really, really good point. I mean, as we see with TCFD reporting as well, I mean, considering how widely it's been adopted, even by organizations that don't yet have to do it, one small fine seems relatively negligible considering the wide-scale adoption. I'm aware that we're rapidly running out of time for this really interesting conversation. We could probably go on for quite some time. I just wanted to give you the opportunity to send out a key message to our listeners, because that consultation is closing in September. So we kind of urging everyone to take this as their summer reading onto the beach.
So as we've alluded to, there is quite a lot of consultations operating over this summer. The consultation we're very much highlighting in terms of the UK sustainable reporting standards and the transition plans closes on the 17th of September. The wider consultation regarding industry-specific standards supporting the ISSB and the SASB standards, that extends until the end of November, but the sooner we can correspond on that one, the better, because those can be folded into iterations as we go. We're also expecting a further consultation from the FCA as to how the feedback, if you like, and how we might apply the sustainable reporting standards and TPT to FTSE listed companies later on, or to the FCA to listed companies later this summer. And as I also alluded to in my remarks, also expecting a consultation to come out from the European Union regarding the ES RS exposure draft as well. So lots of consultations, all of which is incredibly important, and then they should shape them the timeline. We don't have any specific line of sight in terms of the rollout. What I would say is I'm hoping that the level of voluntary adoption will encourage the UK government to proceed at some pace to at least start with, let's say, the largest organisations and the most impactful ones, and then look at that sort of rollout over time to make sure that we've got those flows of information coming from the corporates that then can be taken into the investment decision-making of financial institutions in the UK and further afield.
Well, thanks so much for joining us, Faith and Michael.
Thank you. It's been great to share what we think is a really important time to make your views heard.
Thank you very much.
Well, I hope you enjoyed that conversation with Faith and Michael. If you want to catch up on some of these conversations in person, we've got a couple of events that I just wanted to flag here. So after the summer, we've got the Net Zero Investor Climate Solutions Summit coming up on the 11th of September in London. And also we have got a Net Zero Investor Real Estate Summit coming up on the 16th of September. And of course, not forget to mention our annual Net Zero Investor Conference on the 21st of October in London. I hope I'll see some of you at those events. Thanks for listening.